Welcome back. We are talking to Daniel Tatman about the Palladian Genesis, as it were. We have been talking about early biblical characters. We have specifically been looking at Seth, the third son of Adam and Eve, that have gone very much unnoticed. There's not much talk about this guy, so it's a very interesting character. We might return to this again here a little bit later in this segment. But we're going to begin to look at the Grecian period again and go over a few of the Grecian-Egyptian, I guess, similarities and talk a little bit more about some of the connections. And this is something that that also, I guess, goes very much unnoticed by. Tell us a little bit about this, Dan, and lead us into this topic about the Grecian and Egyptian period of history.
Well, as I said, you know, the major scholarly opinion of architecture is that it runs through Greece, and pretty much the buck stops there. They're happy with that. I guess in a lot of ways you've got the Greek tourist board and lots of other people that would be involved with this. And so they don't really go into where the Greeks absorbed this knowledge from that became their culture, that became their philosophy, that was used in their architecture. They kind of want a lot of emphasis placed on Greece, I think, a lot of the time. And a lot of the documentaries that come out are just trying to get people interested in the topic. So they don't really go into the origins of that again, you know?
It must be that they have this idea that they're the cradle of civilization, and I think that they want to keep it on that level, actually.
Yeah, and almost every country that has a tourist board and has sort of legends or has these places of importance, they do the same thing, don't they?
Yeah.
They really focus on their own country and kind of also if the thing that they're admiring in their own culture is something which, you know, superseded something else.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
They don't usually talk about what came before. Because they're happy about that thing that came afterwards because it's still here and they kind of think that that's good, you know?
Yeah, yeah. I think it's, wasn't it...
You have it happening over and over again, yeah.
Wasn't it Solon who mentioned a little bit about that, the connection that he talked with the Grecians that, you know, your civilization is much, much older and you have borrowed from the Egyptian?
Yeah. Yeah, it also said that the Greek civilization was supposedly kind of the defender of all of the free lands of Europe at that point, and that they actually were part of a rebellion that threw off an older master. And that they were very well respected because of that, and it was because of this that they had so much carnage in Greece. This is what was told to them.
Mm.
So they were basically telling them that they used to be of major importance, you know. And I think it pretty much, the saying goes that now you're like children compared to what you once were, you know?
Hmm.
It's a fascinating quote.
Yes.
So, as I said, the scholarly opinion, they kind of leave it at Greece. But then if you look into kind of the top scholars or the more specialized guys, as I said, they talk about roots to the city of Ay and the Etruscans. And we can take that back then into the Pelasgian. But also, it doesn't just stay in the Mediterranean area at all, in any way whatsoever. And huge emphasis is placed on this by the overall specialists in the field. But we do know that one of the largest temple structures that was found in Assyria, which is known as the Temple of Sargon, which is in Khorsabad, which is now Iraq. Huge temple which had bas-reliefs of gods and angels and all of these happenings in daily life of the Assyrian Empire. And these are stayed intact after the archaeologists went in and rediscovered the area. They took all of the stuff out mostly, and a lot of it is in the British Museum.
Mm-hmm.
And the images that we have often of the winged bull with the head of a man.
Yeah.
This comes from these bas-reliefs at Khorsabad.
Yeah.
But what they don't show in a lot of the exhibits, or the majority of the time, are a lot of the... They've also got bas-reliefs that show the insides of temples from that period.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, we're talking between 3000 and around 600 BC, a long time ago.
Yeah.
And they show quite clearly in some of these bas-reliefs Ionic columns.
There we go.
What we would associate with the Greek style or the Palladian style in later times. the direct Ionic column with the two bunched up scrolls, or as some architectural specialists say, the two ram-like horns of the Ionic column. And that's obviously another way of looking at them. But we also, not only do we see the Ionic, but there's another part of the temple then which has Corinthian columns, clearly.
Okay.
Exactly the same, Corinthian.
Hmm.
So we don't actually see all three of them. We do see plain columns with just a bog-standard kind of capital. So just a rim at the top where it's connecting to the roof.
Hmm.
And a stander at the bottom to connect it, to ground it, you know, to give it more strength.
Yeah.
Which we could say would be perhaps the ancient Assyrian version of the Doric column.
Ah, okay.
The Roman. So we do have all three, but the Doric one is not so clear. The Ionic and the Corinthian columns are clear as day. And they're not shown, hardly ever. And you won't be able to find images of this on the net. You will be able to find in certain pictures, one of the most famous pictures that we have from that region and that time period is a picture of Shamash.
Yes.
Sitting on his throne with the sun disk in front of him.
Mm-hmm.
Lots of people have looked at this, and it's so interesting that so many people have looked at it and haven't seen it quite clearly, that the structure which is actually holding the arched piece of metal or stone which is hanging with the sun disk on it is an Ionic pillar.
Yes.
With the two spirals, you know, so people can see this for themselves.
And
they just type in Sumerian gods or Sumerian art or Babylonian or Assyrian art, and they look at enough carvings, bas-reliefs, and different cuneiform stones, they will see these columns.
Absolutely.
So obviously, there are a large group of people within the kind of the service of the museums, universities, and various groups who must be aware of this.
Yeah.
But this is not talked about.
Do you think it's consciously hidden that you know, it shouldn't be revealed in different exhibits or artworks, frescoes, or, you know, whatever it might be, and that this has consciously been taken off, taken away, taken out?
Yeah, I mean, it seems to be the case, but I don't know exactly why that would be. You know, possibly they think they don't want to confuse people or something. You know, there could be so many different reasons for it.
Right.
Obviously, there is a pernicious element within the higher institutions of our society.
Yes.
Who is very interested in hiding things. But often it comes down to the ignorance of the people involved as well.
That's right.
We have different levels to it. So again, even though we can see these columns in periods much before what we call the ancient Greek period or the Greek Dark Ages, so, you know, from around 1500 BC up to around 400-500 BC.
Mm-hmm.
And obviously this period of their culture overlaps perfectly with what we would call the Assyrian culture.
Mm.
And they're showing the same forms of architecture. And, you know, as you said in the first part, that I've been focusing on architecture, and I'd say in a sense you're right, but when you're looking at architecture or when you're looking at anything in the ancient world, their understanding was that nothing is unconnected, you know?
Exactly, yeah. It's just one form of art expression.
Where I come at it from.
It's,
I see that architecture is, it's ideas in stone. And so it's telling you everything about the culture, even though you're looking specifically at architecture.
Yes.
It's telling you everything else about the people. You know? So I don't see it as so disconnected.
I totally agree with you. I think it's we in this day who are compartmentalizing stuff. And that's probably even why stuff like this can go by pretty much unnoticed, because they might look at this as a background of like art history or whatever, and they don't look at it in the context of architecture, for instance. Although obviously these fields do bridge a little bit here and there, but again, it can be very much plain out in the open, but it goes totally unnoticed for most people, you know?
Yeah, it really does. And it's such a huge period of history, you know, that we're talking about as well. You know, these are thousands of years, millennia.
It's probably one of the most important periods in history, because it seems to be that this is where most of the stuff again is kick-started, and it seems to go from 0 to 100%, you know, pretty much overnight in a weird way, you know?
Yeah. I mean, we mentioned it before with what we call the legacy civilization.
Yes.
You know, and there is a lot hanging on that term. You know, the very word civilization is very, you know, it's a personal term, isn't it? It relates what you feel is civilized.
Yes.
And yet we attribute civilization, this term, to all of these early updwellings of humanity. When we actually look at these places where we do have these upsurgences, they're more empires than they are civilizations.
Yes.
Always headed by a king.
Mm.
And so this continuation, you know, comes up to the present day, you know, with what we would now say our civilization.
Mm.
And the primitive civilization of the indigenous elders, you know.
Yeah, right.
This plugs into the same understanding completely of what you feel is civilized and what you feel is primitive, you know.
Yeah, and what rules we think is the correct ones, or how people even should live their lives. Again, we can bring this into the context of the most current invasion of Iraq. This was also about bringing, you know, civilization to one degree to that nation by those who were, or the allied, you know, forces, so to speak.
Yeah.
And look what happened, you know.
Yeah, absolutely. And so with this whole concept of these kings and these empires, all using this form of architecture from, you know, from actual bas reliefs that we can see from 2500, 3000 BC.
Mm-hmm.
And these are documented in images that you will find around the way, and they're also in museums, a lot of the artifacts. But you can also see it if you look at the, which is a picture that I'll send to you, of the famous winged bull god.
Mm-hmm.
With the man's head. He's a king, and he's wearing a crown. But the way that the shape of the head and the crown on top of it actually sits, you can see that it's emulating, again, a column.
It's
very similar to the Corinthian column. So even though they don't show and exhibit the columns themselves, the same concepts that run through the columns are also in the platforms and the pediments which the statues stand on.
Uh-huh, yeah.
Details around them, and also the way that the actual stone was worked, and the way that the concepts that were going into it, you know, to make it strong.
Yeah.
You would be emulating kind of a brick leaning up against a pillar.
Hmm.
That would be the raw form of that piece of art, you know.
That's really interesting.
So you can see it even in that, in the, one of the most famous pictures of, you know, the, or images from Assyria.
Yeah. Do you think it's because I've been thinking about that aspect of the crown as well? It's must go back to the old story of just, you know, making the head larger or taller, you know, making like I'm an authority, I'm smarter, I have a bigger head, you know. It's like all about the appearance. But I'm looking at the picture right now. I don't know if this is the exact one you're sending me, but I'm looking at that, the human headed winged bull basically, and you're absolutely right. It does look like the end of the top of a pillar. Absolutely.
Yep. Specifically like the Corinthian pillar.
Mm.
It's idealized because he's wearing the helmet of the gods, you know, which some of the earliest Sumerians were wearing. But it's also got this crowned area on top.
Yep.
And it's not, when it's carved as just as a god on a stele, it's not carved in this way. But when it's done in a statuary, they emulate the strongest form, which would be pillars and columns. And
mm-hmm. Interesting, very interesting.
So it's really interesting also that other people have noted this through history. One of these archaeological scholars who's noted this is a guy called Carsten Niebuhr. And he was a fascinating guy. He was born in Germany and went to Egypt and Sinai and all of the Sumerian and Persian empires. With a team of archaeologists, and was involved with the cartography for the expedition. So he was drawing all the maps. And after studying, he was one of the guys who also studied some of the things which were being picked up in the area around what is now called Khorsabad.
Mm-hmm.
And from looking at this region, you know, there's a fascinating quote which he left. And I've got it here, which is... there is a want in Grecian art which no living man can supply. There is not enough in Egypt to account for the peculiar art and the mythology of Greece. But those who live after me will see on the banks of the Tigris and the Euphrates the origin of Grecian mythology and art.
Hmm. Yeah, so he's saying it right there.
Yeah, very eloquently said.
Mm.
And he was also right that, you know, people in the future would see this. This is a long time before the majority of all of the architecture and the cities and everything that were found in this region were even known about.
Yeah, he probably had a hunch that this is where it's leading or going, you know?
Yeah, well, I think also he probably saw a lot of capitals of columns and things like this.
Yeah.
In the early days, there was probably a lot of this around. So, yeah, this is one of the guys who's kind of been talking about this. But, again, this is 300 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And there's been nobody who's been talking about this since, really. And especially not bringing it to the public's view, you know, or to the layman.
Mm.
That's something which hasn't happened at all.
Mm. And we were also, again, we're building the puzzle slowly but surely, so to speak. It's very much, there's a huge record, so to speak, building up. And from this, a picture slowly and surely emerges of what we're looking at. And some, of course, take the alternative view to that, and some take the more accepted or verified view, you know, of it.
Yeah. And for the most part, they do kind of corroborate each other in a way. You know, a lot of the evidences and ideas of the alternative community do agree with the mainstream.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah.
Just they add something to it which the mainstream won't accept often.
Well, exactly. Either the connection between them, or that they are, you know, built on each other. Some kind of, often in many cases, it's just a matter of seeing the pattern of things, having pattern recognition and spotting that, wait a minute, you know, there's something over here and over there that actually fits together. What happens if we do put those together, you know, a somewhat different image, you know, emerge from that?
Yeah, exactly. And that's what we have here with Palladian architecture, you know, and mm-hmm. trying to find the origins of it. We've got the Greek, Etruscan, Pelasgian side of it. Then we've got the kind of Hebraic side of it.
Mm-hmm.
But then we also have this Sumerian account of it as well, you know?
Yes, yes. And again, they're all building on each other, and a culture that emerged in some way from this region, or either from outside influences of whatever, however we want to look at that, but it spawned in that area probably, and then it's slowly have, you know, evolved. It has gone through its own kind of evolution and been more and more refined. And as you say, I think most people, they look back to and say, okay, it all goes back to Greece. But again, what you've pointed out here is that we can go further back into history and spot the similarities between the ancient civilizations.
Yeah, and I mean, the architecture itself is vastly different. The actual forms and the materials and the styles of building are very different in all these thousands of years. But as we're saying, from the evidence of actual bas-reliefs, carvings and images, and columns which are still left, various artifacts, we can see that these orders of columns, which we consider to be the classical orders of columns, which are the defining concept of Palladian architecture, is these three.
Mm-hmm.
Even though there are more overall in classical architecture, these three are the defining element of Palladian architecture, and we do find these three as far back as 3,000-5,000 BC.
Yeah, these are the Holy Trinity, as you mentioned last time.
Yeah, and obviously there's a lot of different interpretations of these columns and why they are carved in different ways, why they become more complex.
Mm.
But perhaps, you know, that's going to be something we'll come back to in the future.
Yes.
I think that's just too big, really.
Tell me a little bit about this, the eight-pointed star. This is something we talked about primarily on live, the webcast that we did, but tell us about the connection here to Greece as well.
Yeah, well, the symbol which I talked about on the live show is, as you said, you know, from Sumer, and the very most archaic forms of symbols that we have for God. Now we know that symbol as Dingir. And Dingir is actually known as the combination of En and Ki, of sky and earth, of male and female.
Mm-hmm.
So in the course of my researching these Masonic marks, and I understood that these were all relating to a different level of masonry, and that you could also apply them to geomancy, and they had male and female equivalents. You know, it became obvious to put the male and the female together just to have a look at that.
Mm.
And it really popped out. But also in The Genius of the Few, and, you know, Christian O'Brien's book really, you know, is a fantastic book. I do encourage anybody to get it because it's got so much material in there from so many different cultures,
mm-hmm.
so many different correlations, which he was noting. Even if you don't agree with the overall interpretation he gives, it's a fascinating book. It really is.
And this is, it's not hard to get or anything, out of print type thing. This is available like on Amazon or something?
I think so. I think of The Genius of the Few, it's relatively easy to get hold of. Of course, people can get hold of Edmund Marriage.
Yes.
Order them directly as well.
Exactly.
To his Golden Age site. He's one of the only outlets for it, really, I think.
Excellent. Okay.
So, yeah, the other one of the correlations which he noted in The Genius of the Few, which is another image that I'll send you to give to people to look at with the show, shows the chronological development of the symbol which he found on the Phaistos disc, this eight-petaled flower, which could be translated into Sumerian as Dingir, as this eight-pointed star.
Mm-hmm.
But another correlation that he also talked about was the eight-pointed or eight-rayed star of Zeus, of the Greeks.
Yes.
And this was a symbol which was always associated with Zeus, an eight-rayed star or an eight-rayed or eight-petaled flower.
Mm.
And this is shown on the Parthenon and many other texts also.
Mm.
We see it in the Knossos tablets. We see it in ancient Greek, both on the north and the south. We see it also in the, up to now, hasn't been translated, Linear A and Linear B, what are known as Cretan Linear A and Mycenaean Linear B.
Mm-hmm. Mm.
That we have this same symbol, this eight-pointed star. And so, as I said, that this is used in the modern mystery schools, and notably it was used in masonry, and perhaps used by Ugo on these cornerstones.
Mm-hmm.
But it was also important to the Greeks, so we're seeing a crossover there between the Greek, Assyrian, or Sumerian civilization.
Yes.
So, as we've noted it in architecture, we're also seeing it in this symbol which they use to denote divinity itself.
Yes. So this is something that has just basically been a symbol that has been carried along with these people, with this civilization throughout the ages, basically, and they've stuck to it, as it were. They've kept it all this time.
Yeah. And obviously, you've got to think about why.
Yes, yes.
And this is something which I talked about in the lecture that I did at the Stars and Stones Forum, is what's called the eight wind system for creating maps. And this would involve literally just putting a dot in a circle, and the dot is a representation of you,
mm-hmm.
yourself,
mm-hmm.
and then drawing a larger circle around it, a circumference, and then breaking that circle up with eight lines, you know,
mm.
to make this eight-pointed star. And this was a way of calculating flat 2D geometry into spherical geometry.
Mm.
And it was used by the ancient Sumerians, and they show it on star maps also. So it was a symbol which could be used to map the land and to turn it into spherical geometry, or spherical trigonometry.
Mm-hmm.
That was accurate to a spherical world. But it could also be just flipped over and relayed up to the stars as well.
Mm.
So we have the Nippur star map, and also a few others, which show this eight-pointed star dividing up the heavens, being
yes.
used as a device.
Yes.
So this symbol was a way of creating maps. It was a way of charting the stars. It was also a way that you could relate to the strength points within a building.
Yeah.
You'll see many roofs, if they've got an eight-pointed or eight-sided roof, circular kind of roof, but with eight sides to it,
mm-hmm.
The way that they actually connect is exactly the same as this symbol in the top of the roof, you know. and this is because it's a very strong shape. You know, it's literally the strongest parts of a building. If you were to take the eight-pointed star and place it over the front of a square building, it would show you the strongest points of it on the front of that building, where the strongest lines of force are. You know?
Right, right.
So it's a architecture as well.
It's a tool. It's something that could be both be used for something practical and for something spiritual. But if we want to boil that down, there really isn't any difference between the two, actually. You know,
especially for these people.
Yes.
Who are living in a connected world.
I'm thinking of.
It's fascinating. You know, it really is. It carries on from this most ancient of periods, through Greece, through Sumer, into Rome, carries on, you know, and eventually turns up being used again by the Masonic guilds.
Yes, I'm also thinking about it in context of the compass rose, for instance, that David Flynn talks about, the 32-petaled rose, basically, and I think that basically is it's a version of the same eight-pointed star, just overlaid it in different, you know, degrees and what have you. You know, it's the same. It could be used in the context of navigation as well, you know.
Yeah, well, if you look at most ships' wheels as well, it's that same symbol.
Yeah, you have the Buddhist symbol, the wheel of life, you know, the navigation of the soul and all that. Yeah,
absolutely. Yeah, and so it was used all over the place, you know, and it wasn't used as an evil symbol or anything like that. It was actually a device, and it was a veiled reference to divinity, you know.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so we see it over and over, and so we see going into Greece and, as I said, into the Masonic guilds. But
yes,
of course, the major thing, which we talked about a little bit in the last piece, is the Temple of Solomon here.
Yes, yes.
You know, the Temple of Solomon being of vital importance to the Freemasons and many other secret societies, to the Christians, to the Muslims.
And to the Jews.
Yeah, to the Jews, yeah.
Yeah.
And also to the Egyptians and, you know, loads of other people as well.
Yeah.
And so, you know, as we've talked about in the modern world, you know, what we can actually see around us at the moment, all of the modern churches, the main sanctum from the actual door to the altar, this rectangular area, is always built in relation to the Temple of Solomon. Always. And then we have every single Masonic lodge, also based on this same rectangular floor plan. And, you know, we've mentioned that sometimes it's scaled up or scaled down.
Yes.
Always the same proportion and numbers
being
used as the Temple of Solomon, the inner sanctum of it. And we also see this in courts. In Britain, we see it in the House of Lords and the House of Commons. You know, we see it in the House of Representatives of America. We see it in almost every important municipal building.
Yeah.
And so, even though with all of these ideas about the Palladian forms of architecture running through Greece and Sumer and Etruria and all of this stuff, the one thing which kind of links all of that together in a historical context is the Hebrews or the Jewish people. They are the people who've gone from Sumer and Babylon down to Egypt, you know, in the supposed times when they were in captivity. They're kind of the connecting thread that goes between all of these places. And, you know, if the Temple of Solomon has placed all this importance on, but again, they don't really talk about the Greek aspect of it, do they? These mystery school guys, these guys that are so fascinated by all of the concepts surrounding Solomon, the supposed greatest magician in all of the world, you know, who's called that by, again, every single world faith. So, you know, we have this Palladian form of architecture always related to these buildings pretty much as well.
You know? Yeah, yeah. So would you say that would you say that the Temple of Solomon is a blueprint for the Palladian style? I mean, I guess that Andreas Palladio would probably have modeled his first sketches on the Temple of Solomon. Would you say that's probably what he did?
Yeah, well, he was copying the temples from Rome and from Greece. But, you know, it's in his writings that a lot of the buildings that he designed, he built on the same ratios as the Temple of Solomon. And, yeah, the overall thing that, you know, that I said that we see in the world around us still is this copy of the Temple of Solomon everywhere.
Yeah.
Alongside this neoclassical architecture.
Mm.
So you kind of have the melding of these two sides of the story again, you know. The story of the architecture coming through Assyria, Sumer, going into perhaps the ancient Pelasgians and Etruscans, coming up then through the Romans, you know, and coming in into the modern world, and then Palladio and all of his contemporaries bringing this style back.
Yes.
Because obviously there was a big chunk of history when this form of architecture wasn't used.
Yeah, would you say that...
Dark Ages, you know?
Would you say that, you know, when the de' Medici family and others were, you know, picking up the pieces of and creating the Corpus Hermeticum again, that a lot of this was brought back, and a lot of the architecture that especially the Medici were sponsoring, that they were responsible, so to speak, to bring this back again into our world?
Yeah, that, you know, I think that's exactly what's meant by the Renaissance, isn't it?
Yes, yes.
That's exactly what's meant by the actual term.
And what is it, sorry to cut you off there, but what is interesting to note that as well is that the de' Medici, for instance, don't seem either to have made a difference between architecture, art, or, you know, sculpturing or whatever it might be. It's just, it's the same basic expression. And again, a lot of the people behind the Renaissance, Caravaggio, you know, I can't think of anyone right now. I know there's tons of names out there. You know, Bernini, Brunelleschi, all these people, they were architects as well as painters and sculptors, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's, as I said, you know, it's to do with a connected worldview.
Mm.
So your art mirrors who you are, you know?
Yes.
Your architecture mirrors you are and the way you think and where you feel your origins are. You know? So this is where the thread was picked up again. But even through the Dark Ages and going into what's known as the Baroque form of architecture, you know,
mm-hmm.
that came in just before the neoclassical Palladian style, you still have this same reference. You know, those same references come back to the Temple of Solomon all the time,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
and the churches and the castles, even though they're kind of more simplified in the details on the outside. The inner proportions and the main chambers were always based on that same thing. So it's still running through there, even though the classical presentation regarding the three classical orders of columns was stopped being used for a couple of thousand years. The inner concept and the ratio of the room itself was still based on the Temple of Solomon.
Mm.
And that got carried on again, you know. So the Renaissance brings back this Greek or classical form of dressing a building on the outside.
Mm.
But they keep within that the Temple of Solomon's ratio.
Yes.
And this is obviously true to its root, because the Parthenon is seen as the best example of the neoclassical, the ancient classical form of architecture. And that is based directly on the same ratio of numbers as the Temple of Solomon, exactly.
Mm.
So, you know, you can see that they were kind of right as well.
Yes.
But they weren't just kind of slewing them together. But they could see that that was, you know, the original resting place. And so, as I said, you've got this, the connecting thread or the connecting peoples between all of this is the Hebrew peoples or the Jewish people, whoever they are.
Yeah, well, exactly, whoever they are. Do you consider that to be a race of people, if we're talking about it in the terms of genetics, or do you think that it's more of an ideology or style or, you know, something else that defines that?
I think it's probably, from the way that I've been seeing it up till now, I'd say that overall they're a group of people, and that the races that are actually comprising that group seem to be changing every couple of generations.
Oh, that's interesting.
It's almost like they absorb new nations, and so they have a falling away of the old group that they used to be mostly comprised of.
Mm-hmm.
So they kind of, as they're referred to in the Bible, you know, they're shepherds. Shepherds are kind of nomadic.
Yeah.
And so they seem to have been going all over the place, and what you do then is you interbreed with the people wherever you are. So you become them and they become you. So you we've got this kind of constantly changing face of peoples, or who we call the Hebraic people or the Jewish people, you know.
Yeah.
It's all the way through history. And we've got that even in recent times with the Khazars, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
Some of the, you know, the different opinions on the different tribes of Israel, you know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's interesting,
yeah,
also.
Overall, I think they're a group of people who seems to change almost their genetic background or interbreed with all of the groups that they're of the area that they're locating at that period in history, you know.
Mm-hmm. And but do you think that it's their background then that they're sticking to, their culture, their religion even, or do you think that also is evolving slowly or changing?
Well, with the architecture, as we said, with these legacy civilizations, you know, in brackets, as I said, we always have these kings. And when you look into the majority of these big legacies, they all have huge square cities with straight lines dividing up all of the towns and everything. You know, the estimates on the Sumerian cities and Babylonian cities is that they were 90% buildings and 10% roads,
mm-hmm.
which is the same division that we have in modern America.
Mm.
So they were real sort of metropolis style and very linear. And so this is coming through the line of kings and empires, is this very ordered form of architecture and a way of creating what they called civilized people.
Yes, yes.
And this carries on, obviously, with the term of civilian, or civi. You know, you've been civilized.
Yes.
By the civic community that you live within, you know.
It to me, when you're talking about this, to me it almost more reflects a mindset or an ideology more than race or culture in that sense. It's more about if you've been infected, if you know what I mean, of that type of thinking, of that type of, you know, meme that you're having in your mind. Because again, many, as you say, many kings, perhaps many people in Europe at that point have been adopting that idea of how to conduct or run, as you say, so-called civilization, you know?
Yeah, a tyrannical empire.
Yes.
Which is obviously the reason that a group of people would move forward so much, supposedly, in forms of architecture or ideas, you know, if they would change so much, is if you've got a tyrannical leader who can do what he wants.
Mm, yeah.
So it changes very quickly. And Akhenaten is a great later example of this in the later dynasties of the pharaohs.
Mm-hmm.
And we can also connect this, you know, back from the biblical account of Cain, and of Abel,
mm-hmm.
and of Seth. You know, even if you look into this son Seth and you go to Wikipedia, you'll see that, you know, Seth is also listed on that same Wikipedia article as the ancient god of Egypt.
Yes, indeed.
Set.
Yes.
Or Setuk. And it's actually referenced as the same. And the reason that is that is that in most of the archaic forms of Hebrew, such as Tiberian, it's actually written as Set and said as a Set without the H.
Mm-hmm. Mm, yeah.
So, again, many, many scholars have talked about this, that perhaps some of these early figures in the Bible are talking about whole civilizations. So we have Cain starting the first city, and this later on being called the land of Canaan.
The Canaanites.
Exactly, yeah. And then at the same point, we have Seth and the children of Seth, who are the Israelites.
Mm.
So, you know, the Canaanites is this area of Meso-Sumeria, you know, and kind of Mesopotamia. And then we have the Egyptians coming through Set.
Mm.
You know, so this is one way of looking at the biblical account.
Could it be that Set, because Set is considered to be the dark aspect, you know, the opposite to Horus. Could it be that, let's say, the Hyksos then, or the Hebrew people were coming into the region at that point, brought with them this idea of Set, and that's why that became later on associated with the darkness or something evil to the original or the Egyptians that remained in the region. Would you say that that's going too far or making connections that aren't there at all?
No, not at all. They are there.
Mm.
They're definitely there.
Mm.
Set was known to have been worshipped at Avaris by the Hyksos.
Ah.
For a long period of time, you know.
That's really interesting.
And even in the most atheistic, you know, these scholars that are really just trying to pick it about nuts and bolts in a sort of anthropology way, they would recount that the story of Cain and Abel is really the story of subsistence farmers and nomadic herdsmen.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, Cain, being the farmer and the tiller of the land, being the story of how the farmers won out over the nomadic herdsmen. You know, so again, even by these guys, the way that they look at it, we'd be talking about two totally different civilizations, wouldn't we?
Yeah, yeah.
One which is farming and one which is nomadic and moving around.
Yes.
So, and the very fact that the Bible calls these Israelites the shepherds, the good shepherds, and herdsmen and flock, and whether it's a lamb or whether it's a ram, there's always these sacrifices that carry on through the later Israelites. And absolutely, I mean, there's so many scholars that have talked upon this, but the major connection between the Hyksos and the Israelites, and perhaps this true identity of who these Hebrew people are, and why they are connected to all of these legacy civilizations, and why, again, in the modern mystery schools, so much importance is placed upon Solomon.
Yes.
And his temple. Why that blueprint was to go on through all of the rest of architecture and to be seen as so important, even in the world that we live in today.
Yeah.
Every important place that we'll have to do things in terms of the society or the government is laid out in this fashion.
Well,
funerals, marriages, all the rest of it.
And with what seems to be regular scheduling in the time and between the ceasefires of the fighting that is going on between, you know, Palestine and Israel, as it were, or, you know, or whatever you want to call the people there or whatever. But that's still something that comes up now and again in the media, and everyone in the entire world, you know, is focusing on this region. And it's very much because of that, you know, the dome of the rock, as it were, the importance of that particular place where allegedly the original temple of Solomon was placed. So energy, so to speak, and focus and attention is constantly going back to this area all the time to kind of feed into it. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, and it's such a travesty, you know, the recent stuff. I mean, it's been going on for decades and decades.
Mm.
You know, the recent Palestinian thing is getting pretty gruesome, you know.
Of course, yeah.
And it's pretty much turned into a complete reversal of the way that some of the Jews were kept in the Second World War, in concentration camps, surrounded by barbed wire, you know.
Yes.
Well, the whole of Palestine is like that now.
Of course, the Gaza Strip is basically a huge concentration camp, as it were.
And, you know, the rabbis and the imams and a lot of the people who really understand the history and the lineages properly will say that the true Israelites are those Palestinians.
Mm, yeah.
You know?
And they've done genetic differences. They've tried to figure it out. You know, when allegedly Israel were researching and building bombs that were genetically specific and all this crap that, you know, apparently was going on, that they couldn't find a difference. There was no difference in genetically between these people, so they couldn't make those type of weapons, you know?
Yeah.
Which is interesting, you know?
Yeah. But it's so strange that we have this, as I said, this inversion of what happened, you know, in the Second World War. You know, Holocaust or nay, concentration camps were there.
Mm.
You know?
Yeah.
And the very fact that, you know, the idea of Holocaust has been so prevalent from Genesis all the way through, you know, it's popped up over and over again in Greek mythology.
Yeah, yeah.
It pops up in Sumerian mythology, you know, and it pops up in our modern context, in this modern story that we're kind of living in, doesn't it? You know?
Absolutely, yeah.
And these themes get focused upon.
And bring it back also to the Cain and Abel story again, right? We're going back to the burnt suffering, the burnt offering that Cain was presenting to God, you know, and that was the accepted version of, or, you know, God favored that, we should say, over, you know, the veg that the cave brought, you know.
Yeah, which is such a huge statement.
Mm.
It really is, and it's carried on in the same way, and the whole lingering on this concept of sacrifice, you know. And I've recently heard a radio interview with Peter Lavender, and he's gone into this explicitly. Blood sacrifice and war and the whole thing and what it entails, or perhaps on an esoteric level, and how politics and all of these events conspire or work towards these kind of goals of using these powerful symbolic images at certain points. You know?
Yeah, yeah.
This is propaganda on an emotional and spiritual level, you know, not just a political level.
Absolutely.
And, you know, he really does wrap this up very well, and Peter Lavender is probably one of the best scholars on these subjects that's out there in the kind of the esoteric, metaphysical, ideological kind of research, you know?
Yes, yes.
And so, yeah, I would recommend anybody to Peter's work, and also Joseph Farrell also.
Absolutely, and we got to have Peter back on the show. We should bring him back again and talk some more about this, because it's fascinating. I think we should begin to look a little bit more at, while we're on the subject of Temple of Solomon, of course, maybe tie this in a little bit with some of Newton's work and begin to look at the similarities in his, you know, ideas with John Wood that you and me have talked about on this show before. But tell us a little bit about what you found on Newton and the relationship to Temple of Solomon.
Sure. We had an economist around the turn of the century, and he was involved with buying the lots of some old papers of Newton's at auction. And I think he got about 10,000 lots, a huge amount of papers, and went through them, and they were kind of jotted down quite liberally by Newton. And they were kind of his hidden manuscripts that had been found after Newton's death and had been labelled by the librarian who was logging all of Newton's artefacts as unreadable. And this was largely because it would have completely destroyed the image of Newton as a full-on scientist and would have shown that he was very, very interested in alchemy and had some pretty controversial views on the Old Testament also. So this was only found out, you know, from 1915 onwards or something. That one of Newton's main interests was alchemy. It was one of his main passions. And Newton, as David Flynn is talking about in his latest book, The Temple at the Center of Time, placed huge amount of importance on the Temple of Solomon. He felt that the actual proportions and shape of the chamber itself and all of the other smaller measurements that were involved with the flanking pillars at the front of the Temple of Solomon, and all of the details of the Holy of Holies, all of these geometries and ratios and sizes and harmonic ratios which were being used, Newton felt that this had everything to do with time. And it was to do with what he felt was a temple to be used as a machine to actually... used for prophecy and used as a kind of a central hub to map time itself on the planet. And so David's really gone into this with his latest book, and it's a very interesting read, and I recommend anybody to it. And it really goes into Newton's ideas. And nobody knew that Newton had these ideas, because as I said, these were his hidden manuscripts, which were only looked at again post sort of 1915, 1920 onwards. So through all the way through this time, nobody actually knew what Newton's real biases were or what he was really thinking about. There was a lot of rumors. There was a lot of ideas that he had interpretations of the Old Testament and that he was kind of a bit wild with some of his ideas. But none of it popped up until reasonably recently, you know.
Right.
And one of the things, as I said, in trying to understand John Wood's buildings in Bath of the current day, what we have left of his architecture, having to go through Palladio, then going through this Palladian route, also saw that, you know, John Wood placed a lot of importance on the Temple of Solomon.
Mm, yeah.
Of course, you could say that, oh,
Right.
But he thought, again, that the three classical forms of architecture come from the Temple of Solomon, directly from there.
Mm.
That they weren't, you know, Wood was a bit more wild in his ideas than Newton, I feel.
Okay.
Mm. He said that they weren't actually inspired by any earlier culture, that they were just divinely given to Solomon by God.
Oh, fantastic.
That's their creation.
Right, you know? Right.
but Wood also felt that King Bladud, who I've talked about, who was the mythical founder of the city of Bath,
mm-hmm.
was Abaris, who's known as Abaris the Hyperborean.
Yeah.
Who was kind of one of the legendary or mythical tutors of Pythagoras.
Hmm.
And one of these old scholars of the Hyperborean region, you know, which has been thought to be anywhere of sort of the eastern coast of Britain,
mm-hmm.
Scandinavia and Germany, you know, Northern Europe.
So do you think that possibly then takes us back to this idea that the original knowledge that were given to the Middle Eastern cultures came from more Western or up north even?
Well, yeah, this is pretty much what he was saying.
Yeah.
Was that it came from one of these Mundi Incognito, it was called, by the later Roman scholars. One of the unknown worlds.
Mm.
And they had kind of four or five of these unknown worlds which had existed and had disappeared. Mm. Hyperborea was one of the names that it was remembered by the Greeks.
Yeah, yeah.
So this is them talking about an ancient place which had disappeared under the water.
Yes.
So yeah, John Wood had a load of really kind of wacky ideas, and so through tracking into this, you know, this is where all of the information of Seth and these other concepts of early Christianity came from.
Very interesting. Do you think
this was weird in itself? But as I said, nobody knew at this period that Newton had these ideas of the Temple of Solomon.
Right.
And so the only two people in history who really went into it, who felt that the three classical orders of columns came from the Temple of Solomon, were John Wood and Isaac Newton. And they were alive at the same period.
Yeah, I think John Wood must have been around in his 20s or something when Newton died, right?
Yeah, well, Newton sort of went through quite a quick downfall in his health, and so he died within a year, but he was quite well up to that period.
Mm.
Even though he stopped taking correspondence, stopped actually inviting people round or going to people, he would take correspondence, and he was writing letters to a lot of people. So, you know, there's a possibility, at least the idea there, that perhaps John Wood, through his involvement with alchemy, as I've tried to show with some of the architecture around Bath that he was involved with,
yes,
covered in these alchemical emblems.
Absolutely, yeah.
That perhaps they were both involved with similar alchemical group which held some ideas.
Yeah, because we know that Newton's interest again in alchemy is huge. That has been, you know, recognized now finally in that sense.
It's his primary influence. Yeah.
Yeah, because we think of him as the. Yeah, the idea of the Newtonian physics, the universe is a mechanism and a mechanical thing, you know, and that's what he has been attributed to. But then the alchemical side has been very much hidden up to this point, basically.
Yeah, the guy who actually translated Newton's alchemical texts, his final surmise of Newton was he felt that Newton was less the first of the scientists, but more the last of the magicians.
Ah, interesting.
And which his overall view after having translated all of these ideas.
Which is pretty interesting that our worldview in that sense has been given to us by a magician then in that sense. I don't know if his work actually was misinterpreted in any way, or, you know, that it has been seen as kind of spiritual, you know, lack of spirit or godless or whatever you want to term it. But I, you know, as is with the case of so many people, they have an idea and just talk about it, and then that becomes misrepresented later on by other people who are making the interpretation. So it's very difficult, at least for me, to know what Newton was into. But it's interesting that his version of the mechanical universe has been given, you know, that we have adopted that, but he himself was very much into the mystical aspect to the universe, you know?
Precisely, and he didn't see it as an inanimate clock. You know, That was more of the earlier French ideas, you know, of Descartes and other philosophers that were kind of more, they felt that it was this inanimate divine clock which had just been kind of left to run.
The Cartesian worldview, I think.
Precisely.
Yeah.
Wood's view was very mystical when you look into his alchemical texts, talking about the same things that he was and his general ideas which were published, but adding a metaphysical or Judaic or Christian or alchemical interpretation of it, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
Adding those other layers in. As I said, it brings up at least the possibility that these two guys were either involved with a common group who shared these ideas, or that perhaps they were in correspondence.
Yeah, exactly.
I know from myself that, you know, being involved with trying to think for myself from a young age, I've written a lot of letters and spoken to a lot of people who are a lot older than me.
Mm.
You know, so I can see that how it can happen if you're very interested in ideas, how you can be influenced also by other people from other generations.
Of course. Well, that's the only thing you have, basically. It's all, okay, it's very much about the environment, and even, unfortunately, back then, you know, very much of what class you were of course, but, I mean, absolutely, that's the way things work, and if you're interested in a few, you know, kind of obscure, as it were, areas, then you probably are going to attract the same people that are of the same mindset and have the same basic interests, you know?
Exactly, yeah, that is the whole nature of our quantum world, isn't it?
Yeah.
And we know that through our everyday lives, that, you know, we draw things to us.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
We draw things to us that we kind of want or would like, or sometimes don't want, but just are kind of drawn to us because it's going over and over in our mind. You know, it is still like to like, but you wish it wasn't so.
That's true. Good point. Well, I mean, it's a fascinating area, and this has been a really interesting continuation with you, Daniel. I think this is a good time here to begin to wrap things up. We have about, you know, I don't know, three, four minutes here left. Is there anything else you'd like to leave us with? Again, mention your website, of course, for us, but other than that, in regards to what we've been talking about, the floor is yours here.
This whole thing is so huge, you know, that all we can ever do is try and point people in the direction of information and ideas that they can read for themselves. Because, you know, we've talked about this before, it's not about having overall answers. You know, that's nice, and that's the goal, is to have a better idea of the contextual world that we live in, you know?
Yes.
But most of the time, the actual journey of reading information, enjoying it, interfacing with it, thinking for yourself, feeling for yourself, is what gives you the empowerment.
Yes.
Not knowing what was said, but actually understanding it, feeling it. And so that's the important thing, really. Even though I feel that I've brought up some points which, you know, we can see from direct evidence, that's not based just on conjecture. I always base most of my ideas upon the actual evidence which is there. And most of the time, when you're talking about architecture, there's buildings still there.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I don't have to make any huge jumps or grasp, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But even though I do feel there's some important ideas there, overall I'm just a signpost.
Mm-hmm.
And I hope that I can do that well and get people interested in these ideas and look for themselves, because there's so much to look at.
Absolutely, and I think that you do it very well. And again, we're looking forward to the upcoming book, of course, about the mysteries. And to give us your blog address so people can go there and check that out.
Sure, it's thebathmysteries.blogspot.com, and they can go there and have a little look at the website. They can download all of the interviews that I've done with you guys, also the show that I did with Greg over at A Cult of Personality, and that'll probably be updated. I've got a few more shows to put up there, so yeah, you can go along there, and you can also pre-order the book from there if you're interested or you want to help me out.
Yes. Okay, very good. And then let's see here. Do you know when your lecture from Stars and Stones is going to be available? Have you heard anything on that?
I haven't. still.
Okay.
I'd say it couldn't be, surely it couldn't be longer than another 2 or 3 months, but I may be completely wrong. So I'll have an update on my site at some point.
Okay, very good. And we, of course, are going to do another live show with you down here, down the road sometime, and continue talking like a bit more about Both and go into a little bit more about the alchemical architecture of Both and continue on that note, since basically where we left off last time we did our live program. So I'm looking forward to that very much, to have you back on the show, Daniel.
Yeah, and then at that point, obviously, we'll be going into the history of Masonic marks as a whole, not just the marks which I've been finding on the cornerstones, but Masonic marks which were used through the Masons' guilds themselves.
Hmm.
The origin of that. So that's a big piece, I feel, to connect to it.
Very interesting. I'm looking forward to that very much. Thank you very much, Daniel, for joining us. Great having you on. We'll talk more soon.
Thanks, man.
Thank you for joining us for part two with Daniel Tatman. And next week, we'll have Hugh Montgomery with us talking about the God Kings of Europe. Much more information on the bloodlines. My name is Henrik, thank you for joining us, and my thanks to producer Fredrik Palmgren. The website is redicecreations.com. We'll see you there, talk more soon, take good care.